I'm Christopher Lydon, re-entering the butterfly world of Vladimir Nabokov, who was maybe the most exalted prose writer of our times in English, his third language, and therefore the most intimidating. Lila Azamzangane says it's a lot easier than we thought. She says Nabokov is all about happiness. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is about the awe, but also the anxiety that comes with the name of Nabokov, author of Lolita and much else, each sentence so perfectly constructed and polished that the reader's first question has to be, am I worthy to read Vladimir Nabokov? Am I ready? Am I getting it? Will I recognize a trilingual pun if I read one? Lila Azamzangane to the rescue, out of the blue, out of her own hard-won but passionate attachment to the writer she never met, comes a short answer to many questions, a little book, beautiful little book called The Enchanter, Nabokov and Happiness. Lila, take a sentence. You gave me one years ago, and I've never forgotten it. I go back to it all the time, in which he spoke in a sort of afterthought about Lolita. He said, for me, a work of fiction exists only insofar as it affords me what I shall call aesthetic bliss. That is, a sense of being somehow, somewhere connected with other states of being where art, that is, curiosity, tenderness, kindness, ecstasy, is the norm.
Isn't that the most beautiful definition of art?
It's extraordinary. Of fun, of anything.
Every time I read that sentence, it makes me smile. And yes, I think his definition of art is very much connected to those things. Curious, you know, first go out, look, open your eyes. Kindness, tenderness, which seems so contradictory with what most people think of Lolita or the dark plots. And then, of course, ecstasy. And that very much is connected to the texture of language, the luminosity of language.
Ecstasy is a tricky word because it's also an illegal drug. I love to think of it, though, as the ecstatic, which is, you know, the state I love most in myself, if I may say.
It's there are all kinds. There's an entire spectrum of color in Nabokov. There is a side of happiness that's quite dark. He even calls it, he says in Lolita, Humbert says that when he possess a nymphette is something that is so singular and so delicious that it's beyond happiness. And he calls that bliss. And bliss in Nabokov always has almost a semi-erotic connotation, consistently so. In Ada, in Lolita, it's always about the texture and the deliciousness of skin and the voluptuousness of Ada, the little cousin in Ada or Arda, and so on. And then the ecstatic really comes in flashes. It comes in moments when he is catching butterflies, a beautiful moment he describes in Speak Memory, where he talks about the feeling, the sense of oneness with sun and stone, a thrill of gratitude to whom it may concern, or perhaps a tender ghost humoring a lucky mortal. And then again, the ecstatic comes in flashes that are just visions. In the darkest moments, he sees things sort of quivering with light always. Mm. And that was really one of the most amazing discoveries about Nabokov, is that page after page, when you begin to notice that really he's a writer of light, when you look at his sentences, everything is gleaming, lustrous, lambent. The vocabulary is infinite, iridescent. All the ripples and the ruffles of the lake are always there. There's something shining and lustrous. It's just amazing.
He loved those L words, as you said, lambent. But hold it right there for a sec. Even after grown-ups learn and accept that Lolita is something other than a dirty book, isn't there something effete about that man, so often pictured with his butterfly net on a green slope in the Alps or in Arizona? I mean, is he teasing us with the beauty of all that leisure, his leisure that most of us don't share?
Yes, of course. He's always teasing. Even when Nabokov appears to be serious. He's always teasing. I remember he appeared in a wonderful television program in 1975. I think it's probably the last interview he gave on television. It was a French program called Apostrophe, and they showed him trying to catch butterflies and not making it. And he looked kind of frustrated and amused at the same time. And the interviewer says, "Oh, but you know, you didn't catch butterflies. It must have been a very frustrating day." And he looks at him with a straight face and says, "Yes, it's a very frustrating activity. It's a very dull and sad activity." And he's, of course, being completely ironic as always. And even he didn't really expect anyone to get it. And yet the thrill he got was something that was deeply contagious, because even for most of us who know almost nothing about lepidopterology, we get to see names, to hear snippets of stories here and there, in the gift, things that are beautiful. If you want, I'll read you a small passage from the
gift. Read anything, please.
Which I absolutely love. And again, one needs to know nothing about the science of butterflies to get this. So this is in The Gift, his last Russian novel and his most beautiful Russian novel. And in The Gift, the narrator, Fyodor, wants to write a practical handbook called How to Be Happy. And here he recollects the lessons of his father, who was an illustrious explorer and an entomologist. And here's what he says. "He told me about the odors of butterflies, musk and vanilla, about the voices of butterflies, about the piercing sound given out by the monstrous caterpillar of a Malayan hawk moth, about the cunning butterfly in the Brazilian forest, which imitates the whir of a local bird. He told me about the incredible artistic wit of mimetic design." And it goes on, and just the descriptions. This is remarkable, to talk about the musk and vanilla odor of butterfly. He even talks about, at one point, he talks about the taste of butterfly.
Well, he says ate he's one, tasted right? a few.
Yes, he ate. Yes, he did. He said it tasted rank, like almond and green cheese. And he was teasing the Sports Illustrated reporter and told him that he sometimes had butterflies for breakfast. And the reporters were so impressed and intimidated by Nabokov, they never really knew what to make of his jokes. And more often than not, they didn't get his jokes.
Lila, he was famous for writing his novel sentence by sentence on 3x5 cards, and you can read them that way. You can see each sentence as a day's work and a little masterpiece often. He's in the business of making these luminous soap bubbles, and it's not easy.
Yeah, if you look at the way he wrote, there was a beautiful exhibit in 1999 at the New York Public Library called Nabokov Under Glass, where the famous 3x5 index cards were displayed. And they're quite beautiful. He has a very, very neat handwriting. It looks almost neurotically neat. And there are some things that he erases and crosses out, of course, but he also wrote out of sequence. He sat down and sort of imagined the whole thing. Also, he loved to say that he imagined everything as though produced on a film reel, and then didn't need to put it together in sequence. So he wrote, for instance, some later part of Lolita whenever it came to him, and so on. And it's also, and then he collected everything in a shoebox. And there are these beautiful photographs of him sitting in front of the Montreux Palace Hotel in the Switzerland resort city of Montreux by the lake. And he has a little shoebox and he's writing that way. And in a way, it's sort of brilliant, because it was a pre-word processor. That's exactly what he's doing. He's just having these different files in which he can cut and paste. He can just add and switch, and it's mechanically very ingenious. And as he's writing on, sort of propped with these index cards on a shoebox, the kind of sentences, for instance, that he comes up in Lolita, although Lolita, I have to say, was not written in Switzerland, but in America. It was written in Cornell, but he was already writing on index cards. And here's an amazing part, again, writing about Lolita, which I love. This is perhaps one of my two or three favorite moments in Lolita. "The lyrical, epic, tragic, but never Arcadian American wiles. They're beautiful, heart-rendingly beautiful, those wiles, with a quality of wide-eyed, unsung, innocent surrender that my lacquer, toy-bright, Swiss villages and exhaustively lauded Alps no longer possess. Innumerable lovers have clipped and kissed on the trim turf of the old world mountainsides, on the inner spring moss, by a handy, hygienic grill, on rustic benches under the initialed oaks, and in so many cabanes, and in so many beech forests. But in the wilds of America, the open-air lover will not find it easy to indulge in the most ancient of all crimes and pastimes. Poisonous plants burn his sweetheart's buttocks. Nameless insects sting his. Sharp items of the forest floor prick his knees, insect hers. And all around there abides the sustained rustles of potential snakes, cadige, of semi-extinct dragons, while the crab-like seeds of ferocious flowers cling in a hideous green crust to gartered black sock and sloppy white sock alike. I am exaggerating a little. And then, meanwhile, he talks about basically, you know, having sex with Lolita and with almost just barely, he says, it was one summer noon just below Timberline, where heaven-hued blossoms that I would fain call larkspur crowded all along a pearly mountain brook, we did find, Lolita and I, a secluded romantic spot 100 feet or so above the pass where we had left our car. The slope seemed untrodden. A last panting pine was taking a well-earned breather on the rock it had reached. A marmot whistled at us and withdrew. Beneath the lap robe I had spread for Lo, dried flowers crepitated softly. Venus came and went. That's it. I don't know anyone else who can pull this off. I really don't.
Joyce, Shakespeare, maybe.
Yes, exactly. In my private pantheon, those three are really the most beautiful writers of the English language. There's Joyce and Shakespeare. Although Joyce, I think Joyce is remarkable in vigor, in vitality, in sort of the sheer breadth and width of linguistic capability. But there's something about their other echo. There's something more textured and more limber about Nabokov's language. And I think Shakespeare does it in a very different way. And this one here, with his three different echoes of three different languages, he twists sentences, and he has a way of just giving us the physical world in such density, shade, just glamour and deliciousness that I'm just constantly smiling, thrilled, delighted. He talks about this spine-tingling quality of good language. And on most pages of Nabokov, I really feel that sort of tingle in the spine. There's something that laughs inside of me as I'm reading. Even the darkest things. He's talking about having sex with a 12-year-old girl. And of course, he's playing a moral game of chess with the reader. And yet, he's also writing the most extraordinary love story. And yet, every detail is a joy to be taken, a moment of ecstasy, a flash of consciousness, of being in the world, of wonder.
Push the meaning of that ecstasy. What is it about? It's not just a thrill. Many great saints of the Christian church aspired to ecstasy, to that getting outside themselves, implying a larger world. It's a very anti-egotistical world. In a certain sense, it has nothing to do with pleasure. It has to do with the spiritual reality or an aspiration to the divine.
Yes, and it does, and I frankly think that in Nabokov there is that dimension as well, although he never talked about it directly, but it does come up in a great number of works. And in fact, he did say, he has this beautiful sentence I think he said in one of his lectures, he said, "I know more than I can express in words, and the little I can express would not have been expressed had I not known more." And that's really...
so beautiful.
It's so beautiful. The little I can express would not have been expressed had I not known more. But there's a bashfulness to his spiritual life. He will never spell it out, because if he were to spell it out, it would become gaudy. It would become... and he never believed in a sort of gaudy paradise or a pilgrimage to an afterlife. But he says that the other world is here at all times. He has another beautiful sentence. He says, "We are not going anywhere. We are sitting at home. The other world surrounds us always and is not at all the end of some pilgrimage. In our earthly house, windows are replaced by mirrors. The door until a given time is closed, but air comes in through the cracks." And he talks about it. It's everywhere. If you look at The Gift, even if you look at Ada, the dead are always sending signals from another place. But it's not, again, the other place is everywhere around us, always. And the tricky thing is, the moment you start trying to put words on it, it begins to sound very corny. Whereas in Nabokov, it always remains, this aspect of him always remains understated. But it's absolutely everywhere. And I think one would miss the true ecstatic dimension of Nabokov if one misses this. He talks about, for instance, again, in The Gift, he says in a short story about a character that he was a pessimist and, like all pessimists, a ridiculously unobservant man. And when you begin to notice and observe, then comes out the strangeness of life. And he says in The Gift, the strangeness of its magic, as if a corner of it had been turned back for an instant. And he says, all this skein of random thoughts, like everything else as well, the seams and sleaziness of the spring day, the ruffle of the air, the coarse, variously intercrossing threads of confused sounds, was but the reverse side of a magnificent fabric. And that's really where his, I would say, his mysticism lies. There is this belief in that we're just seeing the reverse side of a magnificent fabric, and that things really do make sense and gleam on the other side of the fabric, always.
And we're too shy or too discreet or too unworthy or something to name that phenomenon. It reminds me, if I may say, this is going to sound like a leap, but it reminds me of Emerson. I said, I'm an ecstatic. I want to be an ecstatic. And I find even in dull, old, gray New England Ralph Waldo Emerson, a lot of that feeling. He was a naturalist. He was an outdoor guy. And in Nature, he writes this sentence, which to me could almost – it's not – no, it could not be Nabokov, but it's connected. He writes, crossing a bare common in snow puddles at twilight under a clouded sky without having in my thoughts any occurrence of special good fortune – I have enjoyed a perfect exhilaration. I am glad to the brink of fear.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, and it's out on that sort of Nabokovian limb, too.
It is, absolutely. It could almost be Nabokov, strangely, because indeed they, you know, Emerson and Nabokov stylistically are not similar at all. And yet I think there's a quality, and again, calling it mysticism is tricky because it refers to a paradigm that doesn't really belong to either man, I feel, directly in all its various gaudy associations. But in a deeper sense, there is the mysticism of Emerson and his connection to nature is something that is very deeply present in Nabokov. And here is the sentence I love, which really is an echo. I don't know if you would agree of Emerson's relation to nature. Here's what he says. He says, the highest enjoyment of timelessness in a landscape selected at random is when I stand among rare butterflies and their food plants. This is ecstasy. And behind the ecstasy is something else, which is hard to explain. It is like a momentary vacuum into which rushes all that I love, a sense of oneness with sun and stone, a thrill of gratitude to whom it may concern, to the contrapuntal genius of human fate, or to tender ghosts humoring a lucky mortal. And this is the sentence I was looking for earlier. I love that. Behind the ecstasy is something else, which is hard to explain. Isn't it delightful?
Reminds me of another sentence I love of Nabokov's. Consciousness is the only real thing in the world and the greatest mystery of all.
Yes.
Before we leave the 3x5 cards, though, I mean, I'm just struck that the man couldn't help himself from writing these extraordinarily balanced sentences that do end always with a bang. Here's one in which he was just talking about himself as an exiled writer. But he says, I don't seem to belong to any clear-cut continent. I'm the shuttlecock above the Atlantic, and how bright and blue it is there in my private sky, far from the pigeonholes and the clay pigeons. So, end with the pigeon pun.
Yes.
Lila Azam Zangane, we haven't asked you about you and how you came to this very deep friendship yourself.
Yeah, it's, you know, a lot. It comes from family, I think, more than myself. It began with my mother reading Nabokov. She was reading Speak Memory and Ada and Lolita when I was very young, and she kept on saying, "This is not for you." And of course, that sort of elicited rabid curiosity. But I didn't speak English yet because I'm Iranian and I was born in Paris, and I learned English very late. I learned it around 12 or 13, which apparently is sort of the cerebral cut off for good proper language acquisition. So I couldn't read it in English, and I tried French, and indeed it seemed very forbidding. So I waited a few years, and I knew that the Russia that he talks about in Speak Memory is in very many ways reminiscent of the Iran that I never knew, but that my mother knew. My mother comes from northern Iran, and the country estate that she grew up in is very similar to Vera in different ways. And they were by the Caspian Sea, which was also a sea lake. And all her childhood memories, even the little anecdotes from Speak Memory, feel like they're very familiar in strange ways. But for me, it wasn't so much. Of course, it was the echoes of that. But more than anything, it was really the thrill of the sentence. I can't say many people, of course, there was a memoir, which is a beautiful memoir, but it's about the Islamic Revolution. It's called Reading Lolita in Tehran. And of course, many people ask, well, is there a connection between Iranians and Nabokov? But really, for me, it was all about language. It was about the ecstasy that you talked about. It's exactly that, is sinking your teeth into those sentences. And I adore Shakespeare. And I remember you and I 10 years ago having that conversation about Hamlet. I love Hamlet more than anything I've ever read in my life. And yet the beauty, the music of those sentences, you know, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Now, that music is unique. But next to that music, there's a little 20th century music somewhere of these sentences that I have never encountered again. It's a very different melody, but it's a melody so unique that it creeps under your skin and just makes you smile and makes you just more than smile. It gives you a sort of a metaphysical thrill that's what I wanted to translate with this book, really. It was all I wanted to do was, wait a second, you know, Nabokov is not about rape and 12-year-olds. I sat in a lecture a few years ago, and I listened to some professors discussing Lolita, and I thought, wow, a lot of these people sound like they're out of Lolita. They sound like progressive schoolmistresses, you know, talking about rape and incest, and it's so beside the point. He uses that as many games, many mirrors in the iridescent fabric of the work to sort of play with you constantly and push you into corners and make you reimagine and reinvent impossibilities and drive desire as far as you can.
Lila, you say it so well, and I must say I'm moved by the fact that you gave yourself the freedom in this book, The Enchanter, to let it all out in your own ecstatic mode. I want to ask you, though, about a different Nabokov. He's the Nabokov of my night table, the lectures on Russian literature and on English literature or English language literature, in which, for one thing, he can be venomous. He's very, very frank and opinionated, and he's totally contrary whenever he wants to be. I was first drawn to the fact that he loved Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, not exactly, you know, on the all-time top of the hit parade. He loves Lewis Carroll. He also disses and disrespects my man Dostoevsky. He despises Thomas Mann. What does his criticism tell you about his standard of happiness, ecstasy, what literature is supposed to be about? All those questions.
Well, you know, first of all, yeah, he was very pompous, arrogant, and frankly, at times a bit, I disagree with him vehemently, and I love Dostoevsky. I like a lot of the writers that he dislikes. I admire Faulkner, although it's not exactly my home in terms of literature. But I you know, The Sound and the Fury is thrilling and just mind-boggling, and he called it folk literature. literature. And a lot of these writers that he dismisses, I think, are because they're interested in psychology, which Nabokov wasn't interested in. I think a lot of these writers are interested in historicizing literature, in turning into social documents. And he thought that that was crap, basically. He says in the afterword to Lolita, which you quoted, he says occasionally someone has to come and take a good crack at Gorky or Balzac or all these guys who are trying to turn literature into social documents. And literature is supposed to be, he says, it's unique surprises. It has to be absolutely original worlds. But of course, the absolutely original worlds have to be crafted with uniquely spectacular language. So I see what he means, although I disagree, because I think that some of those writers might not handle English as spectacularly as Nabokov, but the sum total of the universes that they create are also remarkable and you know, again, like Faulkner.
He was the ultimate anti-populist in the sense of glorifying people, causes, campaigns, sentiment especially. I mean, I think probably even Dickens was over the top and out of the question for Nabokov. But here's a judgment of his on literature, which I think makes a variety of points, but also the construction of his sentences. It's one of my favorite Nabokov lines from a long essay on Don Quixote and Cervantes. He didn't like the book in many ways. He found it an ugly book about a lunatic. He says, "Don Quixote is greater today than he was in Cervantes' womb. He has ridden for 350 years through the jungles and tundras of human thought, and he has gained in vitality and stature. We do not laugh at him any longer. His blazon is pity, his banner is beauty. He stands for everything that is gentle, forlorn, pure, unselfish, and gallant. The parody has become a paragon." I love that list too. Gentle, forlorn, pure, unselfish, and gallant.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's lovely. Well, again, it's an odd and a quirky take. I know he thought, and apparently when he lectured about Cervantes, he just kept on quoting passages, and he was outraged by the cruelty of much of Don Quixote. I don't know. Maybe it would have done him good to read it in the original Spanish. And when he's being very severe, I always it was very important to me to realize, as I was discovering Nabokov, 10 years ago, that there was much of Nabokov that I didn't like, and also his taste. And he hated women writers, and he pretended he didn't want translators who were women, although he wound up having two whom he admired. But he said, "I'm frankly homosexual on the subject of translators." He was also very much a homophobe. He had very great issues with homosexuality. So there you are. That gives you a few shadows in the painting of the ecstatic man, but it makes you sort of love him all the more.
Leela, you quote a couple of sentences from a Nabokov story, which seems to me not only to embrace the point about happiness, but also to pose it against a kind of contrasting loneliness of the human experience. And I'd love to just read it. He includes it as a letter to a girl he knew many years earlier in Russia. Here's the sentence. "The centuries will roll by, and schoolboys will yawn over the history of our upheavals. Everything will pass, but my happiness, dear, my happiness will remain in the moist reflection of a street lamp, in the cautious bend of stone steps that descend into the canal's black waters, in the smiles of a dancing couple, in everything with which God so generously surrounds human loneliness."
Yeah, I love that sentence. It's one of the most beautiful. It's from A Letter That Never Reached Russia, one of the short stories. And it's sublime. And it really also makes one of the main points of my book, really, is that happiness is about memory. And I think that the central chapter of my book is about that, about how memory memory, through the magic of memory, the past is ever present. And he says at one point in Speak Memory, time does not exist. And that's really what Nabokov is about. It's about observing, it's about recapturing and reminiscing. And again, the past is ever present. And he talks again and again in Ada about the radiant now. And all is there. Everything is there. And time after time, as these characters grow older, they remember and they but the force of memory, and that's why observation is so important, that moment of capturing. And it's always about capturing and recapturing. It's about turning time on its head. And that's where the magic begins. And when one understands that by reading the book, he says, you know, that's enchantment, that you are reading literature in a sense to learn. If there's one thing to be learned, it's not anything social or historical or political or a documentary value. It's really to learn how to observe and parse the detail of the world. And it's all about taking those eyes off the page into the world and just applying.
Lila, you say it so well. We return to Nabokov with new courage. I'm starting again with Speak Memory, and then Nabokov's Dozen, and maybe the collected stories too. But you give us courage.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Christopher.
Thank you. Thank you for The Enchanter, the book on Nabokov and happiness. But thank you also for letting us hear it in your own voice. Lila Azamzangane, thank you. Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.